From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, Conversations and Comments from the National Humanities Center. In the cultural and intellectual cross-currents that flow between Europe and the Americas, the name of Søren Kierkegaard is prominent. Kierkegaard was the Danish philosopher and theologian who lived from 1813 till 1855. One scholar at the National Humanities Center is an authority and has written widely on Søren Kierkegaard. He's Mark Taylor. He teaches in the Department of Religion at Williams College.
Kierkegaard was both philosopher and theologian. How would he have regarded those descriptions about himself?
I suspect that he probably would not have regarded them very well, though we in the 20th century think of Kierkegaard as one of the leading modern philosophers and theologians. Kierkegaard would never have called himself either a philosopher or a theologian. Philosophy for him meant in large measure the dominant philosophy of the day, which was Hegelian philosophy developed by the great German philosopher Hegel, which had made during Kierkegaard's time an enormous impact on Danish intellectual life, and in fact influenced not only Danish philosophical thought, but Danish theological thought as well.
In what way? What was peculiar about what Hegel had to say?
Hegel attempted in an elaborate and a complex system of philosophy to argue that in his speculative philosophy, the truth which had been inherent in the original message of Christianity had come to its most complete expression. For philosophers and theologians after him, there was often an effort to elaborate Hegel's insights by showing the necessary interconnection between Christian faith and philosophical reflection. For Kierkegaard, philosophical reflection did not fulfill, but in fact negated Christian faith, or what he saw as being essentially Christian faith. He never saw himself, he never tried to cast himself as an original thinker, but the term he used to describe himself was always a corrective. He was a corrective, indeed he felt himself to be a necessary corrective, not only to the philosophical and theological tendencies of the day, but also to the social tendencies, because what made Hegelian philosophy and speculative theology so problematic for Kierkegaard was the relationship of these intellectual tendencies to certain social tendencies of the time. Hegel developed, of course, in his late work an elaborate theory of the state, which continues to be very influential in political theory. For Kierkegaard, the emergence of the modern industrial state marked the disappearance of the individual self. Indeed, it is in Kierkegaard that the kinds of protests against the loss of the individual in the anonymity of contemporary social and intellectual tendencies first is heard. So he sees this all-encompassing philosophical and theological reflection as of a piece with the very social tendencies that were making impossible individual authenticity.
Does that mean that he was concerned about what we call the real world, the way people live? Or was it more theory?
He was very concerned about the way people live. Indeed, his whole authorship, an authorship that was very complex, was devised as a way to lead people to what Kierkegaard conceived as authentic existence. Lead them to, because the realization of that depended upon their own initiative. But he identified different forms of human existence. He did not see human experience as being all of a piece, but rather saw different, what he called, stages on life's way, some of which were more, some of which were less authentic. And what he was trying to do was to, in this authorship, was to lead individuals from what he regarded as problematic inauthenticity to a more complete form of individual selfhood. The stages of life themselves are the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious. There are variations on those, but those are the basic three. He tries to identify these as possibilities, as existential possibilities that the individual might or might not realize. Kierkegaard wants to distinguish the religious as a distinctive sphere. Here again, he's not alone there. Coleridge will do the same kind of thing in England. Mm-hmm. He wants to distinguish the religious as a distinctive sphere, which, though related to, is at the same time distinguished from aesthetic and moral experience. And what he is trying to do in all of this is to describe in as ideal terms as possible the different forms of life. You have to remember the situation in Denmark at the time. Denmark had what was in effect a state church. There was a virtual identification between the church and the state, insofar as the priests in the Danish Folkekirke, or a Church of the People, the priests in the Danish Folkekirke were employees of the state. And for Kierkegaard, this represented an unconscionable confusion of what in Luther's categories are the two kingdoms, the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of the earth. And he saw this confusion as being one of the reasons for the disappearance of the importance of individual resolution and decision in religious faith. One became a Christian by virtue of baptism, by virtue of birth into a Christian country. And within this church, one had to make efforts not to become a Christian, but to disassociate oneself from the church, a precise inversion of what Kierkegaard regarded as the real, the genuine situation. He unloaded a devastating critique of the Church of Denmark during his late years in a little publication that was called The Instant, or The Moment. He, in fact, died in the throes of that critique, or of that criticism of the Church, and as a result of that, actually, his funeral itself was something of a controversial occasion in Denmark.
Is there something poetically ironic or paradoxical in the sense that we have a man whose name is Kirke, right, obviously meaning church, right, and you just mentioned the Volkekirke, the church of the, right, people. What does his name mean, just parenthetically?
Kierkegaard means, quite literally, churchyard, or the guard of the kirke, the yard, gore, of the kirke, of the church, kirke. It is now used primarily, and there may be something significant in this, to talk about cemeteries. But yes, there's not only irony in the name. Kierkegaard was fundamentally an ironist and a humorist, two things which are not synonymous for him. Indeed, his magister dissertation, a work that falls somewhere between the American Masters of Theology, or Masters and Doctorate, his magister dissertation was entitled The Concept of Irony, and was devoted largely to an interpretation of irony in its Socratic and modern forms. He understood himself as a latter-day Socrates, a ironic midwife who attempted to engage his reader in dialogue and discourse. It's also the case that Kierkegaard was subjected to scathing attacks on the part of the intellectual establishment in Denmark at the time. And indeed, it wasn't until this century that his ideas provoked very much discussion beyond Denmark. Kierkegaard was not well known. His ideas were not well known outside of Denmark in the 19th century. It was not until the beginning of the 20th century that he began to have any real impact. And then the impact was enormous.
Well, you raise an interesting point here. Whether you're talking about Denmark or you're talking about America in the 19th century or today, just how does one go about measuring the impact of the influence of a thinker like Kierkegaard?
Well, the impact has been simply enormous. His ideas pervade our imagination in ways that we are not fully aware of. The contemporary period in modern philosophy usually is believed to have begun in 1918 with the publication of a book entitled The Epistle to the Romans by Karl Barth. Barth's book, which begins the movement of thought known as Neo-Orthodox theology, which in one guise or another governed the European and American theological scene until the late 50s and early 60s, Barth's book is deeply indebted to Kierkegaard. Indeed, I think that book can be read as a reclaiming of some of Kierkegaard's fundamental ideas.
Now what is this neo-orthodoxy?
Neo-orthodoxy basically was a reaction to the Protestant liberalism and the optimism that went with it that emerged in the late 19th century. That is to say, the kind of progressive liberalism that was tied to certain doctrines of progress and evolution, evolutionary development, simply did not make much sense.
The notion that the world is before us, that we can fix it.
That's right, and that we're progressing somehow in the face of the world wars that tore the Western world apart. That kind of vision did not make sense. Kierkegaard's did. The kinds of categories that dominate Kierkegaard's thought are categories that have become common in our time: dread, despair, anxiety. But it was Kierkegaard who first identified those as dimensions of experience that are in some sense distinctively human and disclosive of human uniqueness. And the conduit through which that influence has been funneled really is a movement of philosophy and literature known as existentialism. The second major point of departure, that is in theology, if the modern period, if contemporary period began in theology in 1918 with Karl Barth, certainly one of the pivotal moments in the emergence of contemporary philosophy was the publication of Martin Heidegger, a German philosopher's, Martin Heidegger's Being and Time in 1927. Heidegger, though not always explicit about it, reworks many of the themes that Kierkegaard had identified, and Heidegger sets in motion a movement in philosophy that has been and continues to be enormously influential. And as that movement of existentialism emerged, the influence of these ideas began to disperse beyond the narrow confines of theology or philosophy proper. For instance, one sees in the dispersal of the ideas of existentialism an enormous impact in the area of literature. One thinks of people like Jean-Paul Sartre or Camus. Neither of those thinkers really would have been possible apart from the kind of reflection that Kierkegaard engaged in. Furthermore, one sees the emergence of certain influences in areas like psychology. One of the most interesting, though now largely forgotten, movements in 20th century psychology was a movement that's called Dasein analysis. Dasein analysis is an elaboration of insights advanced in Heidegger's Being and Time, but the ancestor of those insights is really Kierkegaard, and the fundamental category for many of these thinkers is anxiety or dread.
How do these circumstances that you are describing, cultural and philosophical, how do they come down in terms of the worlds of belief and disbelief? Where do they connect with religion as we would know it just in general everyday terms?
One of the most interesting things I think that Kierkegaard's thought suggests is that the boundary that joins and separates belief and disbelief is much more complex than it's usually recognized. If there was one thing that Kierkegaard seemed certain of, it was his own uncertainty. And he in no way attempted to mitigate that uncertainty. Indeed, in many ways, his thought can be read, it seems to me, as a relentless pursuit of that uncertainty. What Kierkegaard's probing of human awareness suggests is that certainty is never possible, that belief, therefore, is always necessary. Now, that does not suggest that there are not different kinds of belief. To the contrary, there are. But belief is, in some sense, always required precisely because of the limitations and strictures of human awareness. Now, the distinctively Christian form of belief for Kierkegaard was a form of belief which emphasized the absolutely paradoxical nature of religious faith. He interpreted Christ as what he called the absolute paradox, which represented the conjunction of time and eternity, a conjunction that could in no way be rationally understood or intellectually mediated. What that God-man does is pose to the believing individual the most radical form of decision to believe or not to believe. There is no rational way to adjudicate that claim.
Does that mean that there's no middle ground?
There's no middle ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no middle ground in that sense of bringing together those two extremes. There's a coincidence there's a coincidence, but a coincidence is not the same as a coincidence of opposites is not the same as a middle ground, which interrelates those opposites, it seems to me.
Mark, how did Kierkegaard think about issues such as the supernatural issues? You mentioned Christ as a conjunction, a meeting of the temporal and the eternal. Was he himself a believer in the sense that he wanted to strive after these things, or was he more critical of them than a believer in them?
He was critical and a believer at the same time.
Was he a churchgoer, for instance?
No, he was not a churchgoer, except occasionally. He would go occasionally, but he was not what you would call your ordinary Christian churchgoer. In fact, as I indicated earlier, he saw that kind of church going as the falling away from genuine religious belief. That's not to suggest that it could not be the occasion for such belief.
This means that he did not believe in institutional religion? What?
Institutional religion in the form that he knew it, which was the Danish state church, was highly problematic. And indeed, one has to remember that for Kierkegaard, the individual always has a certain primacy over the community. So for Kierkegaard, though human interrelationships are not to be forsaken completely, they can emerge in their genuineness only insofar as the individual has already achieved his own distinctiveness and discreteness. The image that he constantly uses to talk about human experience is human experience as always suspended over 70,000 fathoms, out of sight of any shore. Out of sight of any secure shoreline. That situation of suspension over what is in effect a bottomless abyss, is at one and the same time an occasion for enormous anxiety, but not of despair. Those are distinct experiences for him. To the contrary, Kierkegaard insists that the form of life that most closely approximates Christian faith is humor. Because the humorist is the one who simultaneously resigns himself and yet reappropriates that life. The experience, it's in a very Lutheran sense. It's only insofar as one gives up one's preoccupation with oneself that one is able to be in the present fully. But it is, as he says, always an attachment which is at the same time a detachment. That's the paradoxicality of the life of faith, which is the mirror image of the paradoxicality of the object of faith, that is to say, the God-man.
Again, it's very interesting that you would talk about a theologian in humorous terms, right. One who writes, you know, from a humorous standpoint. Couple of questions. Did Kierkegaard, obviously he had a lot to say about God, did he believe in the devil, and which one was going to have the last laugh if he was a believer in humor?
Kierkegaard doesn't know.
he tells us, did he?
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And
did he believe in hell? Was that a present state? Was that
he talked less about the actuality of hell in mm-hmm. in something like a Calvinist sense,
yeah.
Than he did in an eternal blessedness. That was the language he used, an eternal blessedness, which did in some sense transcend temporal life. Hell would be the non-achievement of eternal blessedness. Now, mm-hmm. whether that would be a state in which some form of consciousness was retained or simply the total obliteration of the self or self-obliteration is never clear. But the notion of humor that is implied in Kierkegaard should not suggest a certainty that things all work out in the end, though for the believer there is that conviction that remains there. Humor involves this simultaneity of detachment and involvement that is so crucial for Kierkegaard. And insofar as it involves not simply detachment, but also reappropriation or involvement, humor is to be distinguished from irony. Irony is for Kierkegaard negative in a sense that humor is not, and therefore nihilistic in a sense that humor is not. For Kierkegaard.
Mark, let's bring him into the 1980s. What do you think Kierkegaard would have made of some of the ethical and theological issues that are floating around today? The death of God, for instance. You yourself are writing a book about that very topic. What would he have made of abortion, prayer in the schools, feminism? Are these things issues which would have engaged him?
I think they would have engaged him formally, but perhaps not substantively. Now, the reason I say that is that in one sense, as I've already suggested, Kierkegaard knew better than any of his predecessors, any of his predecessors perhaps but Hegel, though he knew it in a way different from Hegel, that Christendom, and by Christendom he meant a complex social, cultural, and religious phenomenon, that Christendom, which was realizing itself in 20th century Europe, that Christendom actually embodied the death of God, the death of the God that had been the object of the original believing community.
You mean he believed in a primitive church? He wanted to revert to that? What?
He wanted to revert to a form of religious belief which puts the onus of responsibility on the individual believer.
Rather than the institution.
So that in Kierkegaard's eyes, religious belief in its earliest in the early Christian community came at a very high cost, a cost of enormous suffering. Whereas bourgeois Christianity for Kierkegaard had totally domesticated the Christian message.
More formal, but it
became a necessary presupposition for standing in for good bourgeois standing. So rather than distancing one from a community, it integrated one within that community. Insofar as one can make a distinction between civil and prophetic religion, then Kierkegaard would say that what had been a prophetic religion had been domesticated by becoming civilized, if as it were.
So controversies over issues like abortion and feminism or pornography or prayer in the schools, those would be individual issues to be settled by the individual.
That's right.
Not necessarily issues to be pronounced about by the churches.
He saw, if you recall, I indicated that he distinguished ethics from religious belief in a fundamental way. From Kierkegaard's perspective, ethical norms are not necessarily divinely sanctioned. Rather, they are human fabrications which serve the needs of individuals and communities. Whether or not those human creations represent the way things really are can, of course, not be known, because individuals can never know the way things really are. What those standards do is serve certain needs of community and present individuals with certain decisions that have to be made. Whether or not it is right to do A rather than B can never be known for sure. What is valuable about that situation for Kierkegaard is forcing the individual to make a decision which he will never know for certain was right or wrong. Kierkegaard always leaves you hanging. And insofar as Western culture is tied up in important ways with certain notions of individuality, then Kierkegaard's thought becomes enormously important. He has, throughout this century, a century that has often been plagued by repressive forms of social interaction, ranging from totalitarianism to genocide, he often has been cited as a champion of the individual. In these latter days of the 20th century, it seems to me that precisely the individuality that for so long has been an important bulwark against that repression itself is becoming enormously problematic, and to that extent, Kierkegaard becomes not simply a part of the solution, but perhaps more importantly, a part of the problem that needs to be addressed most seriously.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Mark Taylor of Williams College. At the National Humanities Center, Professor Taylor is writing a book about theology and philosophical deconstructionism. Soundings now turns to commentary from another scholar at the National Humanities Center. John Sikora teaches at Western Illinois University. At the center, he's writing a book about Afro-American slave narratives of the 18th and 19th centuries, a subject which prompts the following comments.
Jeremiah was an elderly farmer slave living in Virginia, who early in 1873 gave an account of his life to a newspaper man from New York City. In the last few years, I've read hundreds of such life stories, known collectively as slave narratives. But Jeremiah stands out, remarkably vivid and alive, as though he were sitting and watching us today. Although he is an old man by this time, probably in his mid-70s, he is described as tall and strong as an oak. Although he did not teach himself to read or write until he was past middle age, he nevertheless seemed to have the wit and eloquence of Mark Twain and Frederick Douglass combined. In slavery, he had been called Henry. With emancipation, people tried to give him a new second name, but he would have none of it. What he wanted was a new first name, the name of that powerful talker in the Bible. And so he became Jeremiah. One good, strong name was all he needed, he said. Jeremiah was certainly a colorful man. He was also an acute observer of life around him. Reconstruction was over, and the 10th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation had just passed. The reporter asked him how his life had changed since slavery. Without hesitation, Jeremiah said, "Some things had gotten better, but most things had stayed pretty much the same." When the reporter expressed surprise, Jeremiah cut him short, saying, "Maybe people changed their clothes, but not their hearts." According to him, the black people of the South didn't have any more say in 1873 than during slavery. The little people, black and white alike, couldn't speak up, and they couldn't vote. Rich landowners made all the decisions and hid behind fancy language they hoped no one would understand. Jeremiah was particularly worried about the health of children, he knew. He had heard some former slave owners talking among themselves, saying, "The black problem would probably take care of itself," as the black birth rate declined. Mothers did have trouble getting enough food for their children, and many black babies were stillborn or sick. Whenever blacks complained, landowners or their representatives told them, "Don't bother your heads over that. We know what's good for you." It's been 90 years since Jeremiah gave this interview, and history doesn't stand still. Nevertheless, he might be talking about today's headlines. Recall the time last fall when certain congressmen, worried over unemployment, asked the White House for political support. A White House aide consoled them with the opinion that unemployed people are often too depressed to vote. Another spokesman for the administration told a group of black political figures about the same time that black America would be much better off if the Great Society programs of the 1960s had never been conceived. At that moment, black unemployment stood around 20%, and several of the blacks at the meeting had had a hand in framing those earlier programs. It was another spectacle of a white politician telling blacks that he knew, far better than they, what was good for black Americans. Then came the news that infant mortality rose sharply during 1982. In at least 8 states, and in many predominantly black areas, the rate of still and defective births began to rise for the first time in more than 2 generations. Jeremiah would probably say he'd heard it all before. Some people never change their ideas. His story reminds us that our history is certainly not dead. In fact, it isn't even past.
John Sikora is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book about Afro-American slave narratives of the 18th and 19th centuries. You've been listening to Soundings, Conversations and Comments from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.